I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Charlie Parker's Yardbird had its world premiere in Philadelphia at the Perlman Theater, presented by Opera Philadelphia, and it runs through June 14th. It's about the 3 days in 1955 that Charlie Parker's unidentified and unclaimed body lay at the morgue in New York City. He was just 34 years old. As conceived by our guests, composer Daniel Schneider and librettist Bridget Wimberly, Parker is visited by the important people in his life, including his mother, his wives, and Dizzy Gillespie. The opera set at the New York City nightclub Birdland that was named for Parker. He's struggling to write a new piece of music and haunted by his past, his demons. Here's a clip from the very beginning of the opera featuring tenor Lawrence Brownlee in the leading role. And that's a clip from the very beginning of Birdland, Charlie Parker's Yardbird, performed by our guest Lawrence Brownlee. He's an opera tenor specializing in a style known as bel canto. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Me, Marty.
You're very welcome. We were just listening to you. Also with us is Angela Brown. She's an opera soprano, currently appearing in Charlie Parker's Yardbird as Charlie Parker's mother, Addie. A great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Bridget Wimberly. She's the librettist for Charlie Parker's Yardbird. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And joining us by telephone is Daniel Schneider. He's the composer of this new opera, and he's apparently sitting on the side of the road somewhere in New York City. Daniel Schneider, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And I should say to our listeners, all of our guests are incredible performers and composers and writers. So just use the words acclaimed, prolific, award-winning, and much sought after as you listen to our conversation. Let me begin with you, if I can, Daniel. I know you wrote this with Lawrence Brownlee in mind. Was it his voice that you were thinking of?
No, actually, that was a plan that Corrado Rovarez and I came up with, you know, when we first met in Lausanne, Switzerland, a couple of years ago. Then he came up with this idea of doing something that's especially written for the voice of Larry. And that was always the initial thought, to write something that fits his voice. And I came up with the idea of doing an opera about Charlie Parker, because I think it's a very important, pivotal point in American music history. And we developed this idea, and I went to recitals, one recital at Lincoln Center of Larry, just to get, to get an impression of his voice, and I was very impressed by his singing, and then it was pretty easy to write the opera after that.
Well, let me get Lawrence Brownlee in on the conversation. How did you prepare for this role of Charlie Parker?
How did I prepare? This has been a learning process for me. I won't call myself a jazz aficionado, but listening to the music of Charlie Parker and some of the other jazz greats during that period in time, where bebop was being developed was good for me. I do a style, as you said, bel canto, which is a very florid style of music. And as we know, that jazz also is very, I guess we can call it florid, but virtuosic, a lot of fast-moving notes. And so since I do that style of bel canto and trying to pair that with jazz, it seemed to work well.
Did you spend a lot of time learning about Charlie Parker's life? Was that important for your
preparation? I did. I did a lot of reading, and of course, YouTube is good for that. And I think it was Bridget who told me to look at the book about Stanley Crouch, you know, who wrote some things about wrote a book about Charlie Parker. And so the research that I did to try to get something about his life and what he went through during that period of time, and just to kind of get a background story. Of course, we know that his music speaks for itself, but a lot of people don't know about the life of Charlie Parker, and I wanted to research that so I could be better informed.
To you, Angela Brown, you play Charlie Parker's mother, Addie,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And you're quite a presence on the stage, I have to say. I saw the performance on Sunday afternoon. How did you prepare for her role? And this is her son who suffers, who has his demons, who makes mistakes.
Exactly. You know, I was telling this story a few days ago that I think I've been playing a mama since I was six.
My part mother of your
said,
nature?
Yeah, it's part of my nature. You know, once they put those sensible shoes on and that lightweight blue dress with the little white collar, I look like my paternal grandmother. And I said, okay, here we go. But I also did a little research on the background of Addie, and I could just feel her, how she felt. What I read was like a stream of consciousness. You know, she was being interviewed because Bridget gave me this research, and she was being interviewed about her child, and whatever came up came out. So whether it wasn't in a chronological order, and I just felt that she had this energy about her that she was very protective. She wanted to take care of her son, but she had to let him live, you know, and make his own mistakes. So in preparing for this role, like I said, I think I've been preparing since I was six.
Yeah.
But she's a mama. She's a mama. And I have a lot of great mothers, including my own, to draw from.
Let me get you in on the conversation, Bridget. You set this in the couple of days after Charlie Parker's death. So he's kind of in a limbo world. No one has claimed his body. So something lives on. What was your thinking?
Well, my thinking was what it might feel like for all of us at that point of after your life is over. What happens? And if you get another opportunity to fix the things you want to fix or the things that you wanted to do that you didn't do, on stage you can explore that. And opera just seemed like the perfect place to do it because it's different than theater in a lot of ways. So that was the jumping off point.
Well, I do want to play, because I know, Daniel, you're going to be leaving us in a couple of minutes. I do want to play another piece from this opera, Charlie Parker's Yardbird. This is a piece called Just As Birds Trying to Fly. And this is Charlie Parker struggling to write this piece of music. Let's just give it a listen, and then we can talk. Beginning of a song, Just As Birds Trying to Fly. And to you, Daniel, I mean, it is about composing, you know, trying to get these notes onto a piece of paper, something I'm sure you can relate to.
This is a very difficult process, and it took a long, long time until mankind was able to do that. I mean, they were painting early on, and they were drawing, and they were, writing poetry 3,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. But writing down music is a very recent thing because the process is so hard. You have to... there's a time component, so you have to control time, and you have to control the pitch levels, and to actually fit that into a system that can be 100% or 100% just reproduced by another individual that doesn't have the acoustic information, first-hand information, is something, a great achievement of mankind. And this aria sort of reflects that. Since Charlie Parker was more of an improviser, he has all these ideas in his head, and now the tedious process of putting it down on paper is something he's struggling with in his, if you want, like last wish to write everything down that he did. This is something that I think every individual experiences, every artist experiences, sure, at the end of his life, that he wants to have something he can hold on. And improvisation is something instant that goes away, and a composition is something that maybe it's another individual in 50 years, 100 years, 200 years can reproduce. So that's the whole thinking behind that part of the opera.
And Bridget, what you wrote was, hear it with your eyes, see it with your ears. It's all up here, pointing to the head. Now it has to go down there onto the piece of paper. I mean, an interesting use of language there.
Well, Charlie Parker.
That was his quote.
That was his quote.
Yes. That's the relationship between seeing music on paper, frozen on paper inside the system. That's the next part of the aria that's not played right now. But that the idea of freeze the music on paper and see it, and the other thing is hear the music, you know, with your ears, which is a very interesting process, as I outlined before. And that's just what the content of that part of the aria is.
And how much did you draw from Charlie Parker's own writings?
Well, there were very few writings of Charlie Parker, and very few interviews that remain. But there's enough books about him, and then, you know, his wife Chan wrote a book. So, yeah, I just simply try to recreate him in other people's words.
Well, let's take a very short break. We have to say goodbye to you, Daniel Schneider. Be careful getting back on the roadway. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Good time.
Composer of the new opera, Charlie Parker's Yardbird, having its premiere, world premiere here in Philadelphia. Staying with us for the rest of the hour, Lawrence Brownlee. He's an opera tenor specializing in a style known as bel canto, and he plays Charlie Parker in this new opera. Angela Brown plays Charlie Parker's mother, Addie, and Bridget Wemberly is the librettist for this new opera. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking to acclaimed tenor Lawrence Brownlee, acclaimed soprano Angela Brown, and they are appearing in Charlie Parker's Yardbird, had its world premiere here in Philadelphia, and it does run through June 14th. That's at the Perlman Theater in Center City, Philadelphia. Also with us, Bridget Wemberly. She's the librettist for this new opera, also an award-winning poet and author of 8 plays. If you want to join the conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Lawrence, you're on the stage really the entire time. I think there might be one little moment where you're not there. How do you prepare, or how are you, or are you preparing for this performance? Are there certain things you do?
Well, I have to pace myself. It's exhausting being on stage. You know, there are a lot of roles that I do where I'm on stage a fair amount, but I have a 2-minute, 3-minute, sometimes 10-minute break from being on stage, and I could run to the restroom or get some water or just sit down. But, you know, I just kind of, in the staging, I get a chance to sit down for a fair amount, so I'm not on my feet per se. But it's just trying to live in the story that I am constantly engaged, so I don't think about the fact that I'm on stage, but just trying to live through all the emotions, and there are many that we go through in the role of Charlie Parker. So just I take it easy the day of the show and just try to, you know, gear myself up to be on stage and be involved in what's happening.
Are you performing tonight?
We are.
So this is part of your preparation?
But I'm sitting down.
But you are sitting down, yes, and you have some water there. I know,
yes,
I know
water
is very important. How about for you, Angela? I do want to play a piece of you singing, but I'm just curious about the kind of prep that you do.
Well, I much like Mr. Brownlee here, I rest that particular day, make sure I take all my vitamins and everything, drink lots of water.
How much water?
I drink maybe a half a gallon because I don't want to drink too much because then I'll have to jump in and out that costume all the time during the show. And it's not a lot of time because this is only a 90-minute program, you know. And I think I have the most costume changes because I'm actually the person that shows the passage of time, you know, within the show. But and I, of course, warm up and, you know, relax and do some exercise and just prepare, get ready to be mama.
Well, we're gonna play another clip, and I have to say this is the audio from the video that was taken of this opera, and it starts, "Ain't easy, it ain't easy to be a mother of a black child, man, a man child, all alone." So you're really singing about what it was like to be Charlie, or what it is like to be Charlie Parker's mother.
Exactly. What it's like to be, probably with everything that's going on in this world, any mama of a black child right now. It's just, you're just scared about everything. And she was scared about everything, especially his different appetites that he had. So,
well, let's give it a listen and then we'll talk some more. Another clip, and just to read what those lyrics say, and then I'll turn to you, Bridget. Ain't easy, it ain't easy to be a mother to a black man child all alone. This land ain't no place for a black man child, got dreams. You keep telling him, no, no, can't go there. No, no, you can't live there. No, no, you can't sit here, can't work there, can't date her. Hell no. Pretty powerful lyrics.
Well, thank you.
I mean, are you talking about the 30s or are you talking about now or both?
I think it's since slavery ended, you know, to the present in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. There's been certainly a lot of advances, but there's still, you know, the lines you can't cross. And sometimes it seems, sounds like 2015.
Well, you kind of reference that as well, Angela. So the feeling is if these are words that have meaning today.
They definitely have meaning today. But with Addie Parker, you know, the reality was if you did those things, harm would come to you. You know, going places, sitting down in the wrong place, going, working in the wrong place, dating the wrong color person. Definitely, it got you lynched in Kansas City at that time, and probably anywhere in the United States.
Well, he liked white women. I mean, you know, we see that.
Well, he had two black wives and two white wives. So he was an equal opportunity lover. Yes.
What were his demons? I mean, he clearly had demons, and heroin, of course, one of them.
Yes. When you think about people think about his addictions, I think that's the first thing. Well, probably his music, and then secondly, I think, would be his addictions. Yeah, he had demons. I'm sure that it didn't sit well with him that he left his wife and his child. And, of course, the way that Ron, the stage director, put that in the show, he's looking at the baby, but we've made a conscious choice not to go close to the baby because I think that there's a barrier there. I think his addictions help him to deal with that. Right after that, we bring the symbol of his addiction, Moose the Mooch, into the opera.
In a wheelchair. Out.
And so, yes, the fact that he left his mama, he's an only child, to a mother who did everything for him because of her guilt probably that she felt because he had a father who wasn't present. So he left his mom in Kansas City along with his wife and his child. He went to, when they talk about his horn in the second act, there's a lot of things that he said. You know, he betrayed many people, but he betrayed even his love for his horn and other things too. I think this is a person who constantly is fighting a lot of things in his life. And of course, the time dealing, you know, with the fact that racism was very much alive and well, and he just survived, I think, because a lot was going on in his head.
And the phrase you use for the heroine, I mean, it's horse or tar horse. I was interested in the tar horse, Bridget.
Well, that was the terminology of the time. So I tried to – actually, I tried not to make up anything other than the fact that he's living while he's dead.
Not easy to do, right?
That's small detail.
Right. But I read everything and had to read it multiple times in different sources before I committed to it. So I just wanted to be as authentic as I could to Charlie Parker's actual journey and the relationships that he had, which were important. The women in his life, I could see where they served a very important relationship that kept him going forward. They were all different, and they supplied different functions at different times in his career. So with Doris, he seemed to be the most successful during that time period. She was very organized. She kept his life in order. Chan was fun and loving and a good time, and he had a good time with her.
Do you think, to you, Angela, do you think Charlie Parker's mother loved him too much?
Well, I guess you can't have too much love, but it may have been in the way she loved him. Kind of excusing some of the things and only excusing it to the public. Not she could see it and she would tell him about himself, but, you know, kind of keep that at home. Right. Don't, you know, share that with everybody. So she was definitely... She protected him to others. You know, she took up for him. But she was very well aware, and she always told him, son, you got to get it together. You know, you have to.
Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. And I have to say the two opera singers that we have with us in the studio have extraordinary careers, and I'm not going to be doing justice to them. We're focusing in many ways on this opera having its world premiere here in Philadelphia. Charlie Parker's Yardbird, our guest Angela Brown, soprano in this opera, playing Charlie Parker's mother, Addie. Lawrence Brownlee playing the title role of Charlie Parker. He's a tenor, a bel canto tenor, and also with us Bridget Wimberly. She's the librettist for this new opera, and we talked earlier in the hour with the composer of this opera, Daniel Schneider. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY to join our conversation. Both of you, you scat in this. Is that part of your repertoire?
No, not necessarily. I come from a background of singing gospel,
right.
And of course I sing bel canto music, which is very florid music. So my voice does move. But I've been telling people all along that I didn't necessarily have a scat language. And so that's something that I'm trying to develop, with all deference to the great scatters of this, you know, the world. Two of my favorite singers in the world are, well, they're deceased now, but Ella Fitzgerald and Mel Torme.
Oh, my goodness.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, I've been listening to them quite a bit. And so in the opera, I don't get a chance to do a lot of scat, but there are about three or four places where I get to do exposed lines that are, I think Daniel took some direct transcriptions of some of the virtuosic scats that Charlie Parker played. And so I'm trying to...
Is it note for note, or do you get to kind of
it
improv
is pretty
a little
it
bit?
Is pretty much. But the bida, budaida, Billy Dalton, that stuff is stuff I've had to make up. So that's me developing my scat language.
You scat too, don't you?
Child. That was a surprise to me. It was funny.
Oh, was it?
Because I saw this music and I was like, Daniel, who did you think? You didn't listen to me, did you, brother? You didn't know you were. I was like, no, my voice doesn't do this. But I had to imagine it. So it was funny. I think finally at the dress rehearsal, I just said, well, and I'd been talking to your cover, Joshua Stewart, and he said, just be free with it. You know, don't try to make it something that makes sense. Let it only make sense to you. And so I closed my eyes and I pretended I was playing a saxophone as if, you know, he got this wonderful gift from his mother. And since the whole song was about saxophone, you know, he's the king of sax. And so I just closed my eyes and did it, whatever, you know. And it worked. And I was like, thank you, Jesus. That was the angels coming down to scat job. I had nothing to do with it.
Surprised your own self then.
I did. I said, oh, that was good. Told you.
There are times, though, when you feel like the music is sort of operating at one level, and as the singers, you're operating at another level. I mean, it does have that sort of, it's opera, but it has that feel of jazz.
And I think a little bit of musical theater from time.
Oh, interesting.
Especially in Addie's part, because it stretches the outer parts of our voices as well as the inner. And you just have to draw on everything you ever learned. Just like Larry said, he has a strong background in gospel. I have that as well, but mine is also musical theater.
Yeah.
So I had to bring in some of that kind of belty kind of thing, but on high healthy belt, to make it more earthy, grounded. Addie is the grounding to this show. She's tethered very well. You know,
you want to add to that?
Yeah, you know, she said, you know, like jazz, we're trying to make it like jazz. And I've said this before, that when you think about instrumentalists, if you think about a piano player, a trumpet player, a saxophonist, they're going to use the entirety of the instrument. They're going to play from really, really high to really, really low, mm-hmm. and everything in between. Singers, most times we sing in about a 2-octave range, not 3 or 4 octaves. So the writing of Daniel Schneider, I think, is very interesting, that he is asking us to sing at the very, very top of your range and also the bottom and everything in between. So for me, that I usually stay on the higher side of my voice, I'm having to sing a lot. But it is like jazz, that you want to use the extremity of, you know, that instrument that you're playing. And so for us, the instrument is the voice. So it's been interesting to grow in that area as well, to have to use the facilities, our voice, every note of our voice.
And you're a bel canto. So,
yes.
So what is your range? How
well, normally,
high do you go?
Well, how do I go? It's usually how low do you go? How high do I go? I normally sing high Cs, C sharps. I know a lot of people that know, that perhaps follow me, they know that there's an opera Puritani where there's a high F written. That's the only high F, and that's usually I scream that.
Is that
and
true?
And I have to wear the tight underwear that day.
Yes, there you go.
But sorry. No, but normally it's, you know, higher. And so it's a set range that I sing. And so, but here in Rossini is the composer I sing quite often. There's a role called Rinaldo in Armida that I sang at the Met. And it also is very much like this.
Oh,
that is very, very low, and it stretches down into the lower parts of my range. I've likened it, this role, to that, in a sense.
Well, as you said, you both have sung gospel. I mean, I would think in many ways gospel is a good preparation for jazz.
Absolutely.
I mean, that there is a lot of improv.
Well, the reason why jazz is because of blues and gospel.
Yes.
You know, so it's just hand in hand.
Right. I mean, the kind of, I guess, flexibility that you
have
to learn.
Absolutely. Improvisation. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Yes. It's they're closely related. But I always say that music, is like the evolution of time. You go, you keep going, and you can see elements of other things from the past. But music is all in the same box. I don't think it's that far away from another style.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And did you always want to be an opera singer?
No.
I imagined myself singing, but I didn't take to classical music until I started studying at Oakwood University and then went on to Indiana University. And I just took to the technique like a duck to water. I was raised in the Baptist church, singing in my grandfather's Baptist church from the age of 5. Did a lot of musical theater, did a lot of gospel. And I've always been a stage animal, you know, so I thought I would do something on stage. And then I had the opportunity to, years ago, when Dreamgirls was on Broadway.
Sure.
Yes. And Jennifer Holliday was the Jennifer singing. And I had the opportunity to go and audition, had a private audition, and to be her cover in New York. And they were preparing the L.A. cast. Well, I was very young at that time, but I had the voice. I had the everything for the stage. But they said, you know, you just need a little bit more, you know.
More what?
I think I wasn't polished enough at that time. And I needed to go and get some more training. I had raw talent at that time. And so that's when I went to Oakwood University and to Indiana University. And, you know, classical music just kind of jumped on me. It wasn't anything that I planned on doing. And I've enjoyed the ride.
Yeah.
I really have, because it has encompassed everything that I've ever done. So opera is great.
And that is Angela Brown, a great opera singer. She's a soprano. She plays Charlie Parker's mother, Addie, in this opera we've been talking about, Charlie Parker's Yardbird, again, having its world premiere here in Philadelphia from Opera Philadelphia. It's at the Perlman Theater through June 14th. Also with us is tenor Lawrence Brownlee, who plays the role of Charlie Parker, and the librettist, Bridget Wimberly. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Do stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Again, talking with Lawrence Brownlee, Angela Brown, and Bridget Wimberly about their opera careers, in the case of Angela Brown and Lawrence Brownlee, and also this new opera here in Philadelphia, Charlie Parker's Yardbird. And again, Bridget Wimberly is the librettist for this new opera. And I do want to play another song. It's Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. And if I can go to you, Bridget, so they were friends. They did music together.
And they created Bebop together.
It's a song where you're singing together, message to the people, no deviation, no hesitation, no segregation. Do you want to just set this up for our listeners at all?
It's a period of time. You know, they had a very close friendship, but it wasn't a long one. Right. When we were watching the movie and they talked, Dizzy Gillespie said, we were fast friends, but not, it didn't last that long. I mean, of course, the life of Charlie Parker was short.
Yeah, 34
years. You know,
years.
34 years old. And so, but they talked about, I've read about, when I think Charlie Parker would go over to the house. I think you may have told me this, and that he would play something outside the door because Dizzy's wife wouldn't let Charlie Parker in that place. And Charlie would play it on one side. Dizzy had the technical background, the theoretical background to put it down. Is that correct, Bridget?
Wow.
And so think about these guys who really, Dizzy says, you know, at the other half of my heartbeat. And that's, their friendship is close. So, I mean, these are two people that needed to meet, worlds that needed to collide. And I think in the music, of course, and the formation and the construction of Bebop, of course, these two people in history were destined to meet.
Well, this is a portion of Bebop's Going to Change the World. It's featuring our guest Lawrence Brownlee as Charlie Parker. Also features baritone Will Livermore, and he is Dizzy Gillespie. Let's give it a listen.
We shall say,
let me correct myself. That was baritone Will Liverman as Dizzy Gillespie. Sorry about that. These are some of the lyrics here. Message to the people, no deviation, no hesitation, no segregation. Hell no, only provocation. Yeah, we face the same evil together. No money, no residuals, no royalties, no mechanicals. We got nothing, no money. Just chump change, that's all we got. Got it, and it goes on from there. You're a poet.
Oh,
clearly,
yeah.
We can see that in these words. And that's a good thing. I wasn't accusing you of
that. It's poignant, though.
It's poignant. Very poignant, sorry. Yes. Now go ahead.
Well, during the time, it was very hard for black musicians to get paid what they were worth. And they had to go get a middleman to go get hired. So this guy made money off of the money they should have made. And then they got no royalties for what they did, and this wasn't corrected till long after Charlie Parker died, and then eventually they made restitution to the composers and singers for not being been giving their full worth. So it was very important. Now Daniel Schneider, as a composer, he understood how you got paid, what mechanicals and
You're supposed to get paid. Yeah,
yes,
right?
You're supposed to get paid. Right. So he was instrumental in that particular song in figuring out what it is that they didn't get.
What was it like to sing with Will Liverman? I have to say, great chemistry on stage.
Yeah, we get along really well. From the first moment that we met, I just thought, wow, this guy's a really good singer, but he's a nice guy. And, someone who has a presence that you feel like they really care about the music and the project, and he's very invested. And so we got on stage. It's been very easy. And Ron just instructed us. He said, have fun. Have fun. So we can, I think, of course, we're both African-American men. We're both close to the same height and stature, which is fun. So it's for us, we feel very powerful in that moment on stage. Of course, we're upset in what we're saying. No money, no residuals, no royalties. And he told us, Ron said, we want you to look out in the audience and look at people like saying, you're the cause of this. Of course, the people in the audience aren't. But to give us an energy or a direction to direct those things to, and it empowers us in that moment.
Let me get a caller, and it looks like it just changed it on me. We have Paul from Phoenixville. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I first want to thank you, Marty, for your wonderful story that you tell, and also for all of your people that are your musicians that are on. You guys have a very beautiful voice, and I just love artists and musicians and anyone who can tell stories that inspire other people, because it's one of the reasons I love listening to NPR, because it inspires me. And I just wanted to call to let you all know that thank you for inspiring me to continue to push for my dreams as well.
Well, Paul, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I have to say it's always a special pleasure for us when we have musicians and performers and actors and people in the creative world as a guest on Radio Times. Let me get looks like Doug from Drexel Hill to join us. Doug, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Yes, I did attend the opera on the opening night, and
great.
Even though the performances were wonderful, I was disappointed in the presentation of Charlie Parker at the end of his life as having failed because he couldn't get to the classical composition. And I know he had talked in 1953 in an interview with Paul Desmond about being invited to study with Edgar Varèse in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of what was in his mind. But from what I know of people who knew him, I did have an opportunity to meet the woman he lived with once a long time ago, Chan.
Oh,
she was
wow.
very nice.
Wow.
And met her daughter, Kim, who, of course, was raised by Bird. And I'm a good friend of Bob Duro's, who, of course, wrote the famous jazz album Yardbird Suite. And, when Bird died, there was graffiti all over the world about Bird Lives. He was very much missed. And he died in the Baroness de Königswater's hotel apartment. And he was watching apparently a TV variety show and had a heart attack.
Well, Doug, let me take your essential point. And it sounds like you're saying, should we think of his life as a tragedy or something else? And if I can put that to you, Bridget, how should we,
Well, for me, his life was not a tragedy. There are people that lived three times longer than he did and have done very little. He did quite a bit in his 34 years. A lot of people call him, the tragic Charlie Parker. I've always said that that is not true. He was not tragic. There are certainly a lot of people who are addicted to heroin. This opera is not about his tragedy. This mm-hmm. opera mm-hmm. celebrates what he did. And what he did was change music and open the doors for all the other musicians to come behind him. And certainly he had his faults. We all have faults. But this opera is about him. Well, if anybody who, if you have an opportunity to do something that you didn't do, at the end, if you don't accomplish it, you have to celebrate the life that you did. So for me, this is a celebration of his life.
I mean, you play Charlie Parker here.
Yes.
I mean, in many ways, it's one can also say at the end you're sort of set free, like those birds
absolutely.
In the cage.
Yeah. Absolutely. And when we go through the final scene, it's kind of like a moment where I get a chance to say goodbye to all the important parts. So, I mean, not everyone, but the major important parts of my life, I get a chance to say goodbye to them. And then as I leave, I say, I know why. And so I know the meaning of my life. I know that I was here for a reason. I know that many, you think about a lot of people who died young, but their legacy still lives on. If you think about Elvis Presley, you think about Marilyn Monroe, you think about so many people who even today we revere and we look back on their lives. Their lives had meaning. Of much like Charlie Parker. And of course, as Bridget said, it's a celebration of his life despite all the things that he went through during his life in that period of time. So I think more than anything, we could call him an overcomer because he did.
How do you see him?
I agree with everything that they have said. And also, he left people behind that will cherish his memory and have elevated him. And Bird lives. That's it, because he lives through their memories, our memories, and his music.
Well, and just this bird theme, I'm back to you, Bridget, which is I also understood that he loved Stravinsky's Firebird Suite. I don't know if I have that right or wrong, but when you think about this sort of theme of, I know why the caged bird sings, that's really the last thing he sings in the opera. Bird, Birdland, Yardbird. I mean, this bird theme is pretty provocative when you think about it, too.
Well, he was the bird.
He was the bird. Exactly.
Yes.
Going back to you, Lawrence, and I was asking Angela about sort of how she started in opera. I was reading about you that you actually thought you might be a lawyer as a kid growing up. So
yes.
No one told you had a great tenor voice?
Well, my parents, my father sings still today, and my mother as well. Very good voices. I tell people they're much more talented than I am. One of six kids, and so I have three sisters that are older than me. I was very good as a young kid getting out of arguments, kind of getting myself out of sticky situations. So I thought that it would be a good skill. I had the skills to be a lawyer. So one sister studied business. The next one studied medicine. The next one studied nursing. So I thought, we have all those things. Why don't I be the lawyer? Then the family's covered. That was my thinking.
And how old were you when you were thinking that?
I was probably 17 or 18 years old because I was deciding what I was going to do. When I went to college, my parents were very, serious about education. My father, he finished high school, but he grew up in the South, and so he didn't have the access, in Georgia to, education, equal education during the Jim Crow laws and stuff like that. And so when he got to Ohio where he moved, he decided that when he had his family, education would be very important and that we would all go into to do higher education. So, law was my choice until people started directing me towards music. And I had that background having sung in church and with my family. But people would tell me, you have something special about the world of music and it's you have an operatic voice, so you have to pursue that. I thought, what? Opera? Are you nuts?
Did your family listen to opera?
They didn't. I'm like everyone else. I would see people on TV or hear something, and I think about the lady with the horns in her head, and that was it. I didn't think opera. But then when I was really formally introduced to the world of opera, I thought, wow, this is neat. And they sing the whole time. And that coincided with the, do you remember the World Cup where the three tenors, Pavarotti, Domingo, and Carreras?
Oh, sure.
It was around the time I was graduating from high school
sure.
that came out. And so when I saw that, I thought, oh, my gosh, my life has changed.
Well, speaking of opera singers with things coming out of their head, to you, Angela Brown, mm-hmm. you have a stage show called Opera from a Sister's Point of View.
Yes.
I guess it's a way to sort of push back on that stereotype. Do you think that still exists today?
Oh, yeah, honey, because, you know, music has been taken out of a lot of the schools. And so kids don't even know about opera, period. Okay, so you have to get to the parents so that the kids can be exposed. So, but and you also have to go to the children. So this show, Opera from a Sister's Point of View, okay, is basically a vehicle that demystifies opera for audiences that normally wouldn't go. Now, I'm singing on the stages of the world. I'm looking out in the audience, and I'm noticing very few faces looking back at me that look like me. Okay, and this, I thought it was just in America. I'm talking about the stages of the world, okay? And at first I thought, oh, well, black people just don't like opera. Then as I started doing opera from a sister's point of view, I found out white folk don't like it. And it's about diversity. It's about breaking it down, letting the people know that you can find yourself in opera. I don't care how many people you paint up. Aida is an African opera. Egypt and Ethiopia are in Africa. Okay, it's African love. Then you have Carmen, that's Hispanic. You have Tosca, that's Italian. You can find yourself in opera if you choose to. All you have to do is do a little creative, you know, self-study of the parts and choose your seat and sit down and enjoy, honey, because opera is something that everyone should be a part of.
Well, speaking of Aida, you made your Metropolitan debut in Aida, yes?
Yes, I did. So glad you mentioned that. No, I did do my debut as Aida in 2004 at the Metropolitan Opera, and I had the opportunity to be on the front page of New York Times and all these other publications, and that's when the star got a chance to rise, and God has been good to me ever since then, and it's still a rolling on.
Well, that's great news. And to you, Lawrence, you also made a debut at the Met in, what, Barber of Seville?
Yes, Barber of Seville, yes. 2007, I got a chance to do that. You know, I think Angela as well, we were both winners of the competition. Mm-hmm. And so that's an opportunity for people to see us. And so what often happens when people win the competition, the people at the Metropolitan Opera and some of the more important theaters in the world, well, all the theaters in the world, I should say, begin to follow the careers of these people and at certain times mm-hmm. see if they get the training or the exposure or, you know, just get the skills really to work on their craft to be able to be presented on the Metropolitan Opera stage. So I won it in 2001, and so 6 years later I had the great honor of making my debut there, and so it's been nice to be presented there often at the Metropolitan Opera.
Well, it's been a great honor for us to have all three of you with us in studio here on Radio Times. Lawrence Brownlee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Marty.
And Angela Brown, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Miss Marty.
You're very welcome. And Bridget Wimberly, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And we've been talking about this opera having its world premiere here in Philadelphia, Charlie Parker's Yardbird, and it's at the Perlman Theater, and it runs through June 14th. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter, how to listen on satellite radio, how to get our newsletter. It's all there. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.